From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is hard to know where to begin the hour on this Monday amid an ongoing pandemic, soaring unemployment, and now widespread protests over the police killing of George Floyd, which in many cities last night led to looting. Yesterday, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin teared up when describing the destruction in her city, and she said this about some of the people out on the streets.
I also want to acknowledge that much of the violence and destruction, both here in Seattle and across the country, has been instigated and perpetuated not by the people most impacted by generations of discrimination and institutional racism, but by young white men. These were not the acts of allies. These were the acts of people who came with their own intentions to destroy, to injure, and to cause chaos.
In Atlanta, Georgia, yesterday, protests started off peacefully. But the Atlanta mayor fired two police officers for using excessive force against demonstrators.
At the same time, in several cities, we saw police officers kneel in solidarity with protesters, voicing their anger over the death of Floyd, who was killed after a white police officer held him down with the knee to his neck last Monday. Let's head to Minneapolis now for the latest from Tim Nelson, who's a news reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. And Tim, there were protests again last night, and what's the latest today?
Yeah, that's right. There were actually two large protests, people on the street in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And as you probably have seen, the one in Minneapolis got onto the Interstate 35W bridge over the Mississippi River downtown. And as people were apparently gathering and even taking a knee on the pavement, this tanker truck came barreling into the crowd. It didn't actually hit anyone, but it was very close. It was just a miracle that that no one got hit there. The folks out on the bridge did stop the truck and got the driver out. He's been arrested and may face criminal charges.
Okay. NPR reporters have also been seeing protesters trying to stop looters, and you actually have some sound from one of them.
Yeah, my colleague Matt Sepik was out at the scene of George Floyd's death last night, about 2 o'clock in the morning at Chicago Avenue and 38th Street in South Minneapolis. And there's been a large gathering there. And, you know, people were watching as someone else came up and tried to break into a convenience store that had been closed right across the street from where George Floyd died. They actually stopped him. Here's what Izzy said happened.
Someone tried to break into the Speedway, and we stopped him, or we attempted to stop him, and he became irate and started it just escalated quick, and then it came over, and we got him over to the other side of the street, got him out of there, and in the middle of that, there was a tussle between him, the crowd, and I was struck with a wrench, but I'm going to be okay.
Now, he was one of hundreds of people gathered there. He wasn't badly hurt, although Matt did tweet a picture of the great big bandage on his forehead from the injury.
We're also hearing folks in Minneapolis are being told to look for arson and bomb materials from outside agitators. People are afraid of outsiders coming in. What more do you know about that?
There really has been a shift this weekend that what people are really worried about are people using these demonstrations, these marches, as cover for ill intent. And we've seen this before. In 2015, Minneapolis police shot an unarmed black man by the name of Jamar Clark. There was a very large demonstration outside a nearby police station. And about a week into that demonstration, a young man, a white man, came to the demonstration and shot five people. Friends of his subsequently told us that they believed he had very racist views. He didn't say anything about that during the trial, but there's some fear that that may happen again here, that there are outsiders who are trying to threaten these demonstrators or, you know, cause havoc elsewhere. And the Minneapolis police are telling people to look out for bottles of gasoline, improvised weapons, cars without license plates, and let them know they think these things are out there and could represent a risk to the community.
Is there a curfew, and are people out on the streets today?
Well, there have been for the last two nights. In some places, in some of the suburbs, there were actually three nights of curfews, but there isn't so far. That said, authorities have been making decisions about public safety on very short notice in recent days. You know, they said they were going to close all the highways in Minneapolis at 7 o'clock last night and very suddenly moved it up to 5 o'clock, apparently responding to, you know, some threat that they perceived along the way here. So we expect to hear today if they intend to extend that. I would not be surprised, although the spokesman for the state said last night that they expect the National Guard is going to be in place and on the ground for some time to come.
That's Tim Nelson. He is a news reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Tim, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, as civil unrest sweeps the nation, the coronavirus pandemic has not gone away. More than 20,000 new cases were reported yesterday in the United States. That is down from a daily peak of more than 30,000 in early April. Let's bring in NPR national correspondent Kirk Siegler. Kirk, more than 104,000 people in the U.S. have now died from this pandemic, according to data collected by Johns Hopkins University. On a national level, has either the death rate or the infection rate come down at all, or are the numbers still rising?
No, they have come down. Nationally, we are seeing the infection rate and the numbers of new reported cases going down, Jeremy. I'd say that's the good news. But as you know, in a country this big, it's hard to just lump it all into one big monolithic thing. We are seeing about a dozen or so states, it looks like, where infections are still going up, in a few states more dramatically than others. And the medical community is, you know, largely cautioning that it's still too early to make any direct links between the some states that still have rising case numbers with specific states that are reopening. The reporting is just not across the board in every state, nor are the levels of testing the same in every state either.
Well, where are you still seeing case numbers going up right now?
Well, like I said, about a dozen or so states still have rising case numbers. California stands out, so does Florida. Other more rural states are seeing big rises, but the overall numbers in some of those states are actually pretty low. One state, to your question, I think that we should probably be looking at closely is Wisconsin. There you've seen cases double in the past 2 weeks, and that's notable because 2 weeks ago, of course, is when the state's statewide stay-at-home orders were tossed out at NPR. We've reported on bars in smaller cities and towns there being crowded and people actually even traveling into Wisconsin with the express purpose of going to those places. But Jeremy, you know, public health officials are telling us that it's going to take more time, like I said, an analysis to reach definitive conclusions on whether, you know, the lifting of these orders are actually leading to spikes in cases. We just don't know yet for sure.
And three of the states that have been hit the hardest, New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, have been expressing cautious optimism that they may be leaving the worst of the pandemic behind them. Do the numbers suggest things are getting better at this point in the Northeast?
I'd say they certainly do. New York, the numbers are significantly down. New Jersey has seen, looks like as of recent numbers, about a 20% drop in new cases. The drops in Massachusetts are even more dramatic. You know, I think what's going to be interesting to see, and it hasn't gotten as much attention, is whether these lockdowns are really actually working as they were intended to. You know, there's been a lot of focus on people defying lockdowns lately, but largely across the country, people have supported and followed them.
Well, and as I've been watching the images of the protests that have been going on around the country, I keep looking to see who's wearing masks. And a lot of protesters actually are wearing masks. But are public health officials expecting another surge to flare up as a result of all these gatherings happening around the country?
I think for sure. You know, they are expecting to see outbreaks. I mean, you think about it. You've been to protests as of high where tear gas canisters are fired out onto these crowds of demonstrators. You know, if you've been around where they go off, you know how awful it can be. At a minimum, you're tearing up. That's a best case scenario, coughing and sneezing. We know that this disease spreads by respiratory droplets. You've got people yelling, chanting at these protests too. A lot of people packed in together. And public health experts, we know, are already warning that we're going to have to work really hard to do tracing and you know, with transmission and detection. We also know they may not know for a couple of weeks. If there's any consolation, I think one small thing is that, you know, for the most part, a lot of these demonstrations are at least occurring outside.
In terms of tracing, is there a national apparatus at this point for testing and contact tracing and isolating people if there are new outbreaks, or is this still up to the local and state governments?
It largely falls on the local and state governments. I mean, the way this tends to work, it's my understanding, in a public health emergency, the CDC will nationally set the policy, and the money then is sent down to local, you know, states and local jurisdictions, mm-hmm. and a lot of times even public health districts within states. It's on them to – the responsibility is on them. They know the areas the best. And this is why I think you're seeing some big disparities in reporting and testing depending on where you are in the country. And, you know, that's a big challenge for sure in how to manage and try to control a pandemic like this when we've got such a big, diverse country with all kinds of different problems and needs depending on where you are.
NPR national correspondent Kirk Siegler. Kirk, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's take a little break from the news of the day for some new music from the band Perfume Genius, which is out with a new album called Set My Heart on Fire Immediately. The New York Times calls it thrilling. Pitchfork says it glides between sublime melodies and grimy guttural dissonance, embracing the joys and burdens of the human body and its innumerable intangible yearnings. The lead singer and songwriter is 38-year-old Mike Hadrius. Here's the song, Your Body Changes Everything.
Your body changes everything. You are anchoring until you fit beneath me, and you're breaking like a wave. Your body changes everything. I can hardly breathe, and now you're right above me, and your shadow suffocates.
I spoke with Mike Hadrius last week, and I asked him what it's like to release an album in the midst of a pandemic.
It feels good to have something out, and it feels good to feel the outside world a little more, you know, and have the music be connecting to people and knowing people are listening.
Well, I imagine you finished this before everybody was sheltering in place.
Yeah. I mean, it's always strange because you have this thing that you made that is essentially created for other people, but it's just sort of sitting there alone for months.
What do you think is different about this album than your previous ones?
I mean, just technically, I'm thinking about albums while I'm making them. I'm thinking about all these songs are going to be a record, and I even know who I'm going to record them with and what the songs are capable of having. You know, when I first started writing songs, I wasn't thinking about an audience. I wasn't thinking about a studio. There was no studio. I wrote and recorded them all in my mom's living room.
And who are you thinking about as you write this one? Or is there a person that you have in mind that you are singing to?
Well, I definitely was singing to people on this record. I think there's some songs that I've made before that I sing at people. Or I feel like I'm witnessed singing for myself on the recording. But these songs, I wrote for other people and to them. And I was thinking about the person listening while I was singing and even performed in a way and even held the microphone almost like I was singing into an ear. Hmm.
Let me listen to one song. The way that this album starts, it's a very powerful song called Whole Life. Let's take a listen.
Half of my whole life is gone. Let it drift and wash away.
Looking at a friend's post online about this after he heard this song, he said it brought him to tears. Tell me what this song is about and what you were trying to say here.
I feel like everything good in my life has come from a real shift and is the result of a real like change of direction. And I could either feel that that was happening to me while I was writing and around the time that I was writing this record, or I was trying to force it. I just want to move towards something else and shake off where I've been and shake off where I want to go even, and just, you know, keep all the good and leave all the bad.
Hmm. It's somber, though. It does sound somber, like you're leaving away something that you don't want to think about anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I'm used to how I live, for better or for worse. And you get attached to ways that you deal with things, ways that you think about things, even if they're not necessarily warm or serve you very well. There's still a comfort in them because they are practiced, you know. And it always feels like sort of sad to let behaviors go, even if they're bad, if you've done them for a long time.
Just for our listeners who don't know much about you, you endured a lot as a teenager growing up in the suburbs of Seattle. Your parents divorced. You were openly gay at 15. You were the target of death threats and homophobic attacks. You had a lot of trauma to endure.
Yeah. I got mugged and I got, you know, harassed in high school, and it was pretty relentless and full on. And essentially, I just stopped going to school and just smoked outside of it for months. I mean, I don't know if I had it any better or worse than anybody else, but definitely enough for me to be processing it for a while and enough to make songs about in order to try to conjure up those feelings that I pushed down about it.
Now, you also have some songs on this album that are much more upbeat than the one that we just heard. I want to listen to one of them. This is called On the Floor.
On the floor, I pace, I run my mouth, I pray and wait, I cross out his name on the page. How much of this washes away? How much of my body is safe? How much am I walking away? How much of this heart is in my rising fall of this chest on me?
Now, this song has a blend of funk and pop sound that make you want to dance to it, but the lyrics actually aren't celebratory at all. What is the story behind this song?
I guess what I was thinking about is how a crush or any sort of unrequited love can feel really selfish eventually. And it just becomes like this obsession that lives on its own. It doesn't really have anything to do with the other person in the end. But at the same time, where it started was like genuinely caring for someone else and feeling love, you know. And then I mixed that in with the feeling of a crush when you're younger, especially as a queer person, that can be mixed with a lot of guilt and shame because you, who you love and who you have a crush on, maybe you're not supposed to, or you've been taught that there's something inherently wrong with that. But at the same time, it still feels warm and joyous and thrilling because you love someone. And those two things existing at the same time is really confusing.
We see you express yourself through dance in the video for this song. Dance and movement have always been incorporated into your work over the years, but it's taken more of a lead role. Now, why do you think that is?
I think part of it is the simplicity of it. I mean, I'm talking a lot about processing feelings and emotions, and I talk a lot and I write a lot and I get sick of that. And, you know, sometimes there's something really uncomplicated about just picking someone up and throwing them across the room. I mean, we're doing it in a performative, artful way, but it's still, you know, selfishly very therapeutic for me. And I don't have to talk anymore. I don't have to think about it. And I felt like I was, you know, just guided by instinct and feeling.
Who are you guided by when it comes to influences?
I think if I was, like, directly influenced by anybody on this record, I was thinking a lot about Roy Orbison and Elvis when I was writing. That specific, like, way of performing vulnerability and masculinity and feel. And the music itself, especially their ballads that I've been listening to since I was a kid. And thinking about what would my music be like, or the things that I want to talk about that are important to me if I filtered them through this way of performing and singing, and also if I structured them like these songs that are classics and that I've been listening to my entire life and not just for like a summer or when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am glad you brought up Elvis, because the last song that I want to play actually is not on this album, but it is it's one that you have done. One of my favorite, maybe my favorite Elvis song of all time. Let's listen.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you.
So can't help falling in love with you in a way that probably nobody's ever heard before. Is it accurate to say that you enjoy the art of reinvention?
Yeah, I do. it's cozy. I find it very cozy. Mm-hmm.
So how do you then take this album and bring it to the world at this point? Because you can't tour at the moment, can you? Like anybody else?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still figuring that out. You know, I had a lot of ideas for videos and for the stage show. And, you know, there are a lot of people involved in it. And it takes a lot of people to do all this. And also you go to a lot of places to do it. And all that's kind of been taken away. So I'm trying to figure out how can I have ideas that feel as inspired or good in this current situation, instead of trying to jam old ones into it that aren't going to really make sense. You know, I don't want to live stream just to do it, because that's what you're supposed to do. I want to make sure when I am doing like a concert from home, which even just saying that is bothersome to me. Maybe if I had like fog machines or something in here. But it's just, I don't know, pointing a camera on myself in this house at this time period just feels very much like something I don't want to do.
That is Mike Hadrius, who is the lead singer and songwriter for the band Perfume Genius, which is out with a new album called Set My Heart on Fire Immediately. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice talking to you.
We've got more information on the new album at hereandnow.org.
In Philadelphia, the National Guard started the day by patrolling City Hall and other landmarks around the city. Most of the protests in the city over the weekend were peaceful, with a few incidents of violence. 4 police cars were burned, and police reported being hit by bricks, rocks, and Molotov cocktails. Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw drew the distinction over the weekend between people peacefully protesting and those who are looting. Let's listen.
I've been a Black woman my entire life. I come from a Black family. I have Black sons. And it only hurts the cause more when you have folks that are acting in misalignment with what we're trying to bring attention to.
Joining us now is WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt from Philadelphia. And Avi, you were arrested during the protests yesterday, and I want to hear more about that in just a minute. But first, tell us what you saw at the protests yesterday.
Yeah, I was at sort of a splinter protest, a really small rally that began just outside the Philadelphia Police headquarters, which are near downtown, or what we call Center City. It was sort of a loosely organized march, about 75 protesters, and they started at the police headquarters and they moved ever so briefly before they were sort of intercepted toward the Liberty Bell and some of the other historic monuments in Philadelphia.
I mentioned you were arrested yesterday afternoon. You were released after about an hour. Can you briefly tell us what happened?
Yeah, so basically within about 5 minutes of this protest slash rally slash march beginning, police started arresting protesters and using pepper spray. I should certainly note that some protesters used abusive language toward the police, and I did see some water bottles that were thrown at the police. I didn't see any rocks or Molotov cocktails, but certainly some water bottles. But sort of quickly, people started being apprehended. Mostly the protesters and myself were moving away from the police on this sort of pseudo march. But at one point, as I was continuing to walk away, an officer approached me from behind, pinned me down on some steps right across from Independence Hall in Philadelphia, and arrested me. I told him several times I was a reporter, that I was there to chronicle the protest, but I was arrested and apprehended anyways.
Yeah, and you rode with these protesters to the police station. What did they share with you about why they were there?
It was really interesting. I identified myself as a reporter and asked them, you know, even though I didn't have my equipment with me anymore, could I continue to interview them and talk with them about their experience? And what I learned is that for almost all of them, this was their first time ever being arrested at a protest. They were sort of new to this. They were mostly younger, in their late 20s, early 30s. And for them, this was sort of like a learning experience about confrontational political action. And I was interested in that angle because in my mind, I'm, as a reporter, wondering, is this moment bringing new people to the political forum in a more active way? And that's kind of what I took away. And of course, there were jokes swapped and all sorts of sort of weird quirks of the moment. But that was the big picture thing that I took away. They were young, they were new, and they were engaged, and they were revved up by this experience.
Yeah, and there's expected to be more protests throughout the day and into the night. That's WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Police arrested more than 4,000 people during the weekend of protests, both peaceful and violent, in dozens of cities across the country. For many, it was a reminder of the civil unrest of the 1960s and the protests after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. We're joined now by historian and professor Peniel Joseph, director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin, and author of the book The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Peniel Joseph, welcome.
Glad to be here, Jeremy.
Well, and first of all, just what has been your reaction to what we've seen over the last several days?
Well, I think like many, I've been very saddened by the death of George Floyd and watching that video. And then to see the protest, especially the peaceful protest, was really a pleasure to see. Now, as those protests turned violent, really through a combination of at times police brutality, but also at times people who have their own agendas, that's been really sad to see. But I think the larger context here is that people are so fed up with not just police brutality and the criminal justice system, but with really decades of neglect and disinvestment and brutality and dehumanization in predominantly African-American communities, Latinx communities, Native American reservations. So I think we're seeing really an outrage being expressed by people of all colors. One of the things that's most striking is the multiracial, multicultural, multigenerational nature of the protesters.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the main message of the protesters is getting out across the country, or do you think that some of the more violent incidents are distracting from that message for the vast majority of Americans?
Well, I think we live in such a polarized country, Jeremy, in such a polarized time. The message is loud and clear. It's a message of social justice. It's a message of racial justice. But depending on your perspective, if you're a law and order advocate, and law and order here being just a code word for the criminalization and the incarceration of African-Americans that's been used from Richard Nixon all the way to Donald J. Trump, then you're going to think that these protests are an example that we need a bigger criminal justice system. We need more jails. We need more police. So I think what we're seeing is at least a cultural civil war in the United States that at times has spilled over into actual physical violence.
You're an historian. In your view, how does this compare to the unrest of 1968 when people turned out to protest in more than 100 cities after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yeah, it's comparable not on the scale of violence, Jeremy, but it's comparable in the sense of you see a palpable tension in the air. And what's also different, vastly different, is that the pandemic has left 40 million people unemployed. So we have a bigger wealth gap than we did in 1968, a bigger empathy gap. And it's not just between Black, white, Latinx, other people, but it's between those who are wealthy, those who are elites, and really those who are suffering and immiserated, what we sometimes call an underclass. I think the biggest difference between then and now is that you've got movements like the Black Lives Matter movement that really have a very concrete policy agenda to try to not only just push through anti-racist policies, but to think about things like guaranteed income, healthcare for all, and really redistributing the resources that we put into our criminal justice system into communities. The Black Panthers discussed this. We think about the Panthers usually as this group that was armed, but the social side of the Panthers had free breakfast programs, free lunch programs. So this is really a problem of race and poverty and punishment that so many people are outraged about in the country.
Robert O'Brien, the president's national security advisor, was asked yesterday by CNN's Jake Tapper if there was systemic racism in U.S. law enforcement, which many people in this country believe that there is. Here's what Robert O'Brien said.
No, I don't think there's systemic racism. I think 99.9% of our law enforcement officers are great Americans, and many of them are African-American, Hispanic, Asian. They're working in the toughest neighborhoods. They've got the hardest jobs to do in this country, and I think they're amazing, great Americans, and they're my heroes.
Peniel Joseph, what's your response to that?
Well, I think that's the absolutely wrong response, but I do think this, that we're faced with this national racial and economic crisis, but we have a generational opportunity to do a few things. To one, acknowledge the depth and breadth of structural racism, of white supremacy in all of our institutions, and to do something about it. The criminal justice system is really a gateway to a panoramic system of oppression in the United States that impacts our public schools, our public spaces. It impacts our healthcare, our employment opportunities. So it really is this huge, huge problem. And when he says that they work in the toughest neighborhoods in the United States, we can transform those tough neighborhoods into really bucolic, great communities if we shift the investments that we've made in criminal justice into the actual people that we're trying to contain and punish. And that's why so many people are out on the streets. The smaller criminal justice system that we have in the United States, the better it's going to be for these neighborhoods and communities. And the bigger we ramp up this rhetoric of law and order, the bigger we continue to deny the racism in our institutions, the more uprisings and the more violence and the more dissatisfaction and disappointment in the United States and its institutions, and really American democracy and its institutions, we're going to see.
We heard a lot of reactions over the weekend from police and city leaders around the country, including in Atlanta. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms criticized the violence that she was seeing. Listen.
So what I see happening on the streets of Atlanta is not Atlanta. This is not a protest. This is not in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. This is chaos. A protest has purpose.
What do you think of her words there, Peniel Joseph?
Well, I'd say that one, the looting is not the problem. I'd say that the violence that we're seeing comes straight from the top. The president of the United States has inflamed pre-existing racial division in this country through an embrace of white supremacists. So when we see the president calling for law and order, the president saying, tweeting out, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, of course we're going to see chaos in this context. Of course, we've already heard reports and seen reports that right-wing forces are doing graffiti and defacing buildings and institutions. So there is chaos, but that chaos is not coming from the people. It's actually coming from the government. And what's so interesting is Mayor Lance Bottoms, who I admire, she's evoking Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I study Dr. King, and Dr. King called rioting the language of the unheard. And he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, trying to bring people together towards a poor people's campaign that was going to guarantee Black citizenship and Black dignity, not just for the African-American community, but for all communities, including a guaranteed income. And King's notion of citizenship meant these fundamental rights of health care, of voting, of a decent place to live. So people should not just evoke King vis-a-vis nonviolence and not talk about the truly transformative world that he wanted us all to live in.
You mentioned King being assassinated in April of 1968. Just a number of months after that, Richard Nixon was elected president. Do you think that President Trump is looking at the reaction to the riots in 1968 and saying this could be useful to me politically?
Absolutely. One word of caution for everyone who thinks that in the context of the pandemic, in the context of these real political rebellions that we're seeing across the United States right now, it means that there's going to be a changing of the guard in November. Richard Nixon, Hubert Humphrey, George Wallace were the three candidates for president in 1968. And forces on the left were so divided that Hubert Humphrey ends up losing a very, very close election. After Nixon is inaugurated in January of 1969, many on the left felt that his policies would be so repressive that they'd be able to get a progressive person in like George McGovern in 1972. That turned out not to be the case. So, but I would say that the difference between now and then is that you see the multiracial character of the protesters. We have a generational opportunity to squarely confront this history and to move in a new and more progressive direction.
That is Peniel Joseph, who is the director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
As we head into the hot months, many Americans will struggle to pay for utilities like air conditioning, which in many parts of the country is not a luxury, but a necessity. Cities often open cooling centers for people who don't have it at home, but will people even want to go to those places like this during this pandemic? Mark Wolf is an executive director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. It represents state directors who are participating in a federal program to help people pay for this utility. And Mark, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Yes, glad to have you. So, Mark, before this pandemic, the Low Income Energy Assistance Program already did not have enough funding to help everyone who qualifies for it. Now we're in this complicated time where the need might actually be greater. Can you give us an overview of the average person who would be eligible for this program and how much people will actually be able to get from this program?
Sure. The average household, that might be a better way to put it, would have an income maybe up to $35,000, even $40,000 in some states for a family, say, of three or four. Average grants to cover heating and cooling work out to about $500. And we've had enough money to reach really only about 20% of the eligible population. Oh, wow. A smaller number of states run cooling programs, but this year is different. We've received more money from the federal government. We received an extra $900 million in the first stimulus bill. So most states, especially warm weather states and states out west, will be offering some form of cooling this summer. We also provide supplemental air conditioners for families that don't have air conditioning systems or window air conditioners. One of the concerns about cooling, and this is what I think is important for people to understand, it's many low-income families are reluctant to turn on their air conditioners, even if they have them, because of the extra cost.
That brings up the point about the demand for this bill payment assistance and perhaps how it's changed over the last couple of months with a lot of people who have lost their jobs during this time and people also, as you mentioned, working home now more than ever. Are you able to determine how widespread the struggle to pay for things like air conditioning is at this time, especially in light of the fact that many utilities are not required to report how many customers are struggling to pay their bills?
We know about 28 million households, roughly about a third of all U.S. households are eligible for energy assistance. We can help about 6 million of those every year. We've looked at the data. Many people who were employed before the virus and maybe were over income, now because they've lost their job, they're technically eligible for energy assistance. We think there's another 6 to 8 million households that are eligible. So we're very concerned about the availability of funds. So we asked Congress for another $4 billion. The House recently passed a supplemental bill, which included an additional $1.5 billion for energy assistance. The Senate hasn't acted yet. Now, many states, including, say, California, for example, have blanket moratoriums. Families cannot be shut off from power if they don't pay their bills. But those moratoriums will end, and then what happens?
Yeah, that goes through 2021. But as you said, it also doesn't apply to all utilities. And considering that other states have a patchwork of laws in place about this, what other policies do you recommend going forward to make sure people have their basic utilities met during this pandemic?
One is we need to extend the supplemental unemployment program. Families receiving an extra $600 a week if they're unemployed, that can help them pay for their energy bill. I think the second thing is we do have to add money to energy assistance programs because elderly people are not working. So they're not getting those funds. And this is a way to help them. One thing I think that a lot of people don't realize is this. So half the people who receive Social Security have no other source of income. They barely make it through the year. And one way they do it is by not turning on their air conditioning. But this summer, we're telling people they need the shelter in place. And so it puts an additional burden, and we need to pay for that. We can't ask people to make additional sacrifices. Because in a sense that if we said, look, there's no additional money, we can't have a society where 10% of the population is shut off from power. I mean, that is what could happen if we don't have additional funding and the pandemic continues and people don't get reemployed. And these dire kinds of scenarios are possible, but they don't have to happen. And I mean, the deal isn't over yet. Congress still has time to act. But we're very worried about this.
What recommendations do you have for people who are in need of assistance and they're hearing this right now?
Well, if you are in need of assistance, if you don't have an air conditioning system or an air conditioning unit, we do have a hotline that you can call that can direct you where to go for help. So even though I've said, yes, we don't have enough money, we do have resources, though, that are still available, and we really want to encourage people to apply.
And we'll have a link to those resources at hereandnow.org. That's Mark Wolf. He's executive director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.